Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It would require a greater philosopher and historian than I am to explain the causes of the famous Seven Years' War in which Europe was engaged. So wrote William Makepeace Thackeray in 1844 in his great novel The Luck of Barry Lyndon. Indeed, Thackeray goes on to say, its origin has always appeared to me to be so complicated and the books written about it so amazingly hard to understand that I have seldom been much wiser at the end of a chapter than at the beginning, and so shall not trouble my reader with any personal disquisitions concerning the matter. Well, I have Dominic Sandbrook with me, of course, and Dominic, we relish a challenge, do we not? So we are going to engage with the causes of the Seven Years' War.
Well, not only are we doing that, we are venturing into a real super league of podcasting situation now, aren't we? I mean, we really are now becoming an elite closed shop, because our guest is not only an expert on the Seven Years' War, he is one of history's absolute elite. He is the Real Madrid of history podcasts. Not that we're not Barcelona, but this is a podcasting classico.
Yes, it is, because we have with us Dan Snow. Who, Dan, have you done podcasts before?
No, this is my first. Can you hold my hand? I thrash myself to death. To thrash myself to death doing podcasts, as you want to, because you've been on about 64 of them.
But more germanely, you are also the author of Death or Victory: The Battle of Quebec and the Birth of Empire, an absolutely splendid account of the Siege of Quebec, the death of Wolfe, all that kind of stuff. So absolutely the perfect person to have on. But also, Dan, it's very exciting for us, not just to have you on the show, but also to be doing an 18th century topic, because I realised that although we've done, what, Dominic, about 40 odd episodes now, we haven't done one exclusively on the 18th century. And I think that's a real gap.
Listeners, I am shaking my head with disappointment, but not with surprise. Because Sandbrook's proclivity.
What is it about the 18th
century? What is it about the 18th century? Who would even ask that? I tell you who would ask that. Somebody who writes books about the 1970s. Come on, man. I mean, I've given up on you a long time ago, but Holland, I've always seen a spark. I've always seen a spark of recognition, despite his obsession with the ancient Near East. I've always deep down known that he's an 18th centuryist at heart, and we could win him over. And yeah, it does get a decent heft in your new book, which I'm glad to see, Tom. But the 18th century, first of all, obviously the important kicker here is that 18th century is steel, the best years of the centuries either side. So it's 1688, 1815, obviously the long 8th century. This is when it all happens, guys. All these people focus on the 19th century, talking about your Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution is an 18th century phenomenon. That's where it begins. There are 17th centuryists now kind of picking up their phones, getting ready to tweet, so don't at me. But science, as we understand it, Newton, of course, 17th century, but it works into the 18th century. You've got Voltaire, you've got Hume, you've got Montesquieu, you have got Locke, you have got Wollstonecraft. This is when our modern world is being shaped. By the end of the 18th century, you have got you've got people suggesting that working people and women should be allowed to vote. You have got a very strong abolitionist movement. The end of the 18th century has got the same kind of discourse. And the American Republic has been born, the first republic, successful republic, governed by a written constitution. I mean, this is a transformation in the history of the human race. And I always think, you know, you've triggered me now, guys. But I mean, you know,
yeah, he's off.
There is,
he's off.
There
he's
are,
off,
there are. There are, you know, like birth of the Royal Society and things in the 17th century, and also there is a whole raft, as you know, of brilliant scholars telling us how fantastic the early medieval and medieval scholars were at science. But I do think it's fair to say that something quite dramatic happens at the end of the 17th and the 18th. We get a recognisably modern world, and from the piston, from the train, from the piston that drives those trains along at the very beginning of the 17th century. Or that I should say, drives those steam engines along to landing on Mars and launching a drone is a direct line. We're close.
An Augustan achievement. So Dan, you've listed the amazing achievements of the 18th century, the Enlightenment, the seabed of the Industrial Revolution, of the American Revolution, of the French Revolution. We are focusing on a war. And we're focusing on what is actually a very, very important war, what could possibly be described as the First World War. Would you view the Seven Years' War as a conflict on a level with the Napoleonic Wars, the First World War, the Second World War, as one that shapes not just British history or French history or European history, but global history?
Much more important than those you mentioned.
Much more important than the First World War. What a great claim.
I mean, the First World War, which sees the four great empires, the Habsburg, Hohenzollern, Romanov, and Ottoman Empire, just falling apart within 2 years. I'll row back on that slightly. I think the Seven Years' War is fundamentally important. I think it stands shoulder to shoulder with those ones in India, in terms of the which we can talk about. The spread of Britishness, trading practices, legal practices, language, governing practices in India, and of course, fundamentally in North America. It gives us an English speaking. We used to be able to say, when I wrote the book, we could always talk about like kind of Anglo-Saxon ideas of government, but of course now
I don't want to get into that particular poll, don't get us cancelled.
Exactly, that's cancelled. But it was quite a useful term for 18th century to describe an English-British way of organising societies. And organising economies and political economies. So I think it's fantastically important. It is also part of this thing called the Second Hundred Years' War, which is much more interesting than the First Hundred Years' War, which is this extraordinary global conflict from 1688 to 1815 for global hegemony between, remaking Europe, but also global hegemony between Britain and its colonial competitors, in the end, France. And that's a war that ends literally with the Duke of Wellington watering his horses in the Seine and sleeping with Napoleon's mistress. You know, that is an extraordinary conflict, no less dramatic than the flag that hangs on the Reichstag in 1945, and one of enormous importance.
Is the Seven Years' War a war? Or is it, you know, the First World War, we know when it started, we kind of know when it ended, or it's slightly muddy. The Seven Years' War, is it a distinct war? I mean, there seem to be different dates about when it started. It's kind of piggybacking on different conflicts all across the world. Is it a distinct thing, do you think?
I think you're trying to get me to talk about the Third Carnatic War here, aren't you? You're right.
That old trap.
Yeah.
Dan, could we, just for those who are not familiar, yes. There are very few listening who are not familiar with the Seven Years' War. I mean, the dates... As in the history books, 1756 to 1763. Although,
well,
yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Are they?
Yes, Dominic, and you're both right. But Tom, I don't you yourself down. There's not very few listening. You've done really well. It's been a big success. It's a nice little project for you. And I wish
I think
it
we should wind the podcast
best.
Up now, Tom. He's the wrong guest. Let's be honest.
So no, it is a war. The war in India is a sort of parallel conflict and one that is only very vaguely linked to the war in the rest of the world. And that's where we should point out that William Pitt the Elder, who was not Prime Minister during the Seven Years' War, he was arguably the kind of global strategist, the Secretary of State, the sort of, if you like, the Foreign Secretary, the person in charge of the strategy. He had very limited, he did virtually nothing in India. You see the first British Redcoat Regiment, the first British Army Regiment arriving in India in this period to take part, plays a decisive role in this war. You also see Royal Navy ships in the Indian Ocean, but you know, it takes months for information to get back and forward. So local commanders are acting on their own initiative. For example, in India, you get the Black Hole of Calcutta we want to talk about. That's a war that has been going on between effectively the kind of crumbling and sort of semi-autonomous Nawab of Bengal and East India Company forces. When the British discover that there is also a war in Europe and North America has broken out, they then go on the offensive. Extraordinary action. The Royal Navy sails up to Chandanagar and buys a very expensive victory, smashing French power in and Bengal. So they are related, but they're not all part of one great Churchillian war rooms, let's move bits around the map sort of strategy. The war in North America is fascinating because it begins... This is unusual, this war, is that the great wars of Europe, the War of Austrian Succession in 1740... the War of Spanish Succession, the Williamite Wars of 1690s, they tend to begin in Europe. This actually begins in North America. And this is what's amazing about the Seven Years' War. It doesn't last 7 years. You quite rightly point out the fighting has been going on since at least 1754 in North America. And in the Pennsylvania backcountry, this war, the shots that will ignite this global war, are fired by a little band of American loyal colonial troops, loyal to King George II, led by the young George Washington. It's unbelievable. Yeah. It's so exciting. So George Washington is going in, it's a colonial militia from Virginia, head in. France claim the whole of the Mississippi Valley, all the area drained by the Mississippi, which is a gigantic swathe of America.
Is that because they wanted beaver?
They wanted beaver, Tom. They wanted beaver. They had the fever, but it's not the first time that
Tom
that
is that so cheap.
Been made.
I tried to work with that, but I just couldn't in the end. And so they, in fact, we should come back to beavers because that's what Voltaire was particularly rude about, beavers. But they claimed this giant swathe of North America, New France. Britain had a tiny little strim, little sort of bit up the east coast, the colonies on the east coast. But there were lots more people in them. It was very densely populated. And inevitably, lots of those people started crossing the Allegheny Mountains into the Pennsylvania backcountry, knocking into French forts, French traders. And you get friction on the colonial frontier, which is very familiar later in the 19th century. But that starts the Seven Years' War. You get fighting between Britain and France. And I've got to say, Perfidious Albion, extremely unimpressive. I mean, you get this. I hope, as you're hearing, by the way, that Thackeray was completely wrong. The Seven Years' War is very easy to understand. We haven't quite come to Europe yet, but this is in North America. It's quite straightforward. And then we haven't talked about Frederick the Great, which we must do. But in North America, there is fighting. And then, amazingly, the Royal Navy, France sends reinforcements to North America, and the Royal Navy ambushes them. A brilliant Admiral Boscawen in 1755 captures two troop trips and fires on them before a declaration of war. I mean, it's pretty naughty stuff.
So we've got India and we've got America, but then we also have Europe. And you mentioned right. Frederick the Great. And it's kind of interesting, actually, Dominic, thinking about it. In this podcast, Frederick the Great appeared in our very first podcast. And he's popped Greatness. Up like a kind of spectre on the margins of various
Prussia,
episodes.
Wasn't he?
Yeah. And I think I said before that of all the kind of the remarkable figures in history that I know very little about, he's the one that I really want to know more about.
You keep working him in when he's not. I mean, you got him into, you probably got him into the Eunuchs podcast, did you?
I think I missed him out on that. But in the story of the Seven Years' War, Dan, Frederick the Great is the kind of the key player on the Continental War.
He is.
Tell us about him and what's going on there.
Well, you're sounding now like the Duke of Newcastle, who was the Prime Minister in the 70s War. And well, when we finally found a stable, when the British finally found a stable governing coalition during the 70s War, very, very, very successful administration, one of the most successful administrations in British history. The Duke of Newcastle handled the money stuff, and William Pitt was then free to spend astonishing amounts of money, like more money than the British have ever spent before on violence, waging war on several continents. The Duke of Newcastle, however, said, my price for doing that is I need to keep this, I need to be focused on the war on the continent. So while you're stripping the French and later the Spanish of their colonies around the world, I need to support Frederick the Great in Europe. This is where it gets slightly complicated. Britain had Hanover. Hanover is this incredibly hard to defend state in North and West Germany. The King George II is the elector of Hanover, the Prince Elector of Hanover. He says to Duke of Newcastle, you can run my administration, but for God's sake, keep the French out of Hanover. I want you to look after Hanover. So Duke of Newcastle says, fine, we will flip this great diplomatic, we have the so-called diplomatic revolution. We will pay the Prussians to protect Hanover from the French, which means, unfortunately, going to war against it means being on the other side from our old allies, the Austrians. So you've got Maria Theresa and her Austrian Empire, Austro-Hungary, and the French fighting Frederick the Great, who's trying to enlarge Prussia. Over the course of Frederick the Great's life, Prussia doubles in size. Prussia becomes the thing that will eventually as we know, go on to dominate Germany with some small consequences for 20th century history. And the Seven Years' War is part of Prussia, Frederick's view of an expanded Prussia being tested by fire. The Swedes invaded, the Russians invaded, Berlin was occupied, Maria Theresa's Austrians got their act together briefly and were able to inflict a few defeats on Frederick the Great. So Frederick the Great is fighting this unbelievably complicated war on all fronts in Europe. Funded by the Brits, paid for by the Brits. He also dispatches one of his rather good generals to look after Hanover, and they do that very effectively. And Frederick wins some stunning victories. The reason this war is completely different to the War of Austrian Succession, which has gone before, and various other wars, that, for example, the French Revolutionary Wars that almost kill William Pitt, they're very frustrating. They can't find anyone to beat Napoleon on the continent initially. What's brilliant about the Seven Years' War for Britain is they are able to do the things they're best at. They're able to send this Royal Navy slowly developing a marked advantage over technically in terms of their training, in terms of their tactical ability over their competing European navies, the Spanish and the French. They're slowly getting qualitatively better, and they're quantitatively much better because they spend more money on it. So that they're allowed to go and do that. They capture all sorts of colonies everywhere, from Cuba to the Philippines. Extraordinary, the greatest run of success in British history. Although with a predictably British slow start, which we could also come to. It's fascinating, this sort of Second World War, Napoleon Wars, First World War. There's always a kind of, there's also a warming up period required to the British war effort, which is so interesting, which has probably got something to do with the channel and the space that Britain has to sort of take its time. Anyway, but on the continent, Frederick the Great is able to defeat all comers in the most extraordinarily dramatic series of campaigns. And so it is said at the time that the British Empire in North America was won on the battlefields of Germany. So it's this extraordinary combination.
But Dan, we have troops in Europe too, don't we? Aren't they commanded by the Marquess of Granby? Isn't that right?
Yes.
Aren't all those pubs named after the, you know, he's only remembered as a pub now, but at the time, isn't he leading our troops in Europe? Am I wrong?
Pub signs are very... The Seven Years' War is more around us than we might think. So, you know, there are pub signs, the Prince of Prussia, the Marquess of Granby, all those pub signs anything to do with Wolfe. There were more pubs about General Wolfe in the past, but those pub signs are all, from this period. There was a battle, a great forgotten battle of British history. It's another one of the... We could talk about the year 1759, Annus Mirabilis, the most successful year in British history, when the Battle of Minden took place, when the French were decisively defeated on the continent. But there were many British forces there, but not under kind of coalition control, this kind of Prussian coalition command. It's not one of those sort of British battles that really excites, but it's hugely important. But what it does is it basically pins down French forces in Europe, stops the French doing what they usually do, which is get completely hammered in the colonies, in India, in North America. They lose Louisbourg, for example, the huge fortress sitting in the mouth of the St. Lawrence River in the War of Austrian Succession. But then the French basically invade Belgium and the Netherlands and various other places. And Britain, in order to restore the balance out, in order to kind of compress France into a manageable size, this great and enduring problem of English and British strategy makers, policy makers, in order to compress France back down, you have to sacrifice all these colonial gains. The key difference with the Seven Years' War is you can keep more of your colonial gains at the end, because Frederick the Great and this army in Hanover have catastrophically defeated France in Europe. The bit that the French are usually good at, they've done badly at. So they've got no chips on the table at the end of the day.
Okay, should we focus on the year of victories?
Yeah, let's do that.
That's kind of feel.
Why not?
So this is a year of absolutely storming British victories over the French. Dan, give us all a patriotic thrill by.
We don't have any French listeners, do we, Tom? Not that I'm aware
maybe
of.
Maybe not. Well, apologies if we do.
Well, not anymore
By going through the full scale of what happens in that year.
So there's a very odd and predictive, as I say, there's this kind of classic British slow start. They lose Menorca.
Admiral Byng hanged to encourage the others, doesn't he?
Well, he gets shot on his own quarterdeck. Voltaire quips to encourager les autres, so to encourage the others. And things go badly in North America. The Marquis de Montcalm, you may have seen the film Last of the Mohicans, he manages to beat the French out of Fort William Henry. Basically, there's an invasion corridor between what is now the USA and France up Lake Champlain. This wonderful sort of, it links Albany to Montreal, basically. And so for hundreds of years, the French and British, of course, overlooked, but fundamentally important Native American allies have marched up and down this invasion corridor, and it like a tide coming, sort of receding and advancing. And the French march down, they successfully take Fort William Henry, many of the surrendering garrison are massacred, as depicted, and Daniel Day-Lewis does his stuff. So that's a kind of, and Britain also...
That's the Mohicans and all that.
That's the Mohicans. I should have mentioned, right, that dropping Daniel Day-Lewis in there was probably slightly obscure. But Edward Braddock and George Washington, again, they're annihilated. One of the greatest defeats in British history in 1755.
Washington seems absolutely terrible.
He's terrible. He's terrible. Listen, we could do another podcast about George Washington. I mean, my God.
Yeah, okay. Rushes around losing battles in the.
But you know what? He's young, Tom. He's young. He makes his mistakes early, and he learns a lot. Yeah. He learns a lot.
Yeah. Okay,
and then he performs reasonably after that. And that should have been the end of him, really, if it hadn't been for bloody post Seven Years' War fiasco.
Yeah,
but anyway,
we'll come to that, won't we?
So then in 1759, everything kind of falls into place, and the reason is it's the giant spending by the British government, the famous fiscal military states that the 18th century historians like to talk about, where these states have come into being very modern states where you can borrow at low interest rates because you've got a faintly reliable, the lenders are suitably confident that you're going to get that money back. There is a legal system, there's a political, you can seek redress within Parliament. It is far from being a very modern, sort of completely, brilliant, sort of a very modern state in which things are perfectly transparent, but it is groping towards that place. So Britain can borrow, even though it's a smaller economy, it can borrow titanic amounts of money, which is unavailable to the French because they're mad, ancien regime despots who just choose not to pay it back or spend it on stupid things like enormous palaces. Whereas the British can say to people, lend us money, we're going to spend it on ships that will protect trade and you will then benefit from that trade and we will make money on the tax that derives from that trade. So there's a system that works. So Pitt and Newcastle and the British government are able to send huge amounts of ships and men to all these theatres at once. That's what's so extraordinary about this. They're able to keep the war going in Europe whilst also dispatching the biggest expeditionary force in history, really, to North America. And that means that by 1758, there's a bit of a stuttering start, but 1759, it all comes into place. A young British officer called James Cook, again, interesting character here, grows up in a kind of illiterate, very marginal family. He goes to sea on the coal trade, Newcastle supplying London with coal, this kind of giant industrial city in the south, accessing the Saudi Arabia of energy in the 18th century, which is the coalfields of Northumberland. He learns his trade there in brutally difficult navigational pilotage conditions. He then joins the Navy, volunteers join the Navy on the outbreak, and is rapidly promoted, joins as an ordinary seaman, but rapidly promoted, becomes an officer. So again, the Royal Navy, an engine of meritocracy in this period. Imperfect, but key to its success. James Cook creates the first chart of the St. Lawrence River. The St. Lawrence River, vast, complicated river running into the heart of Canada. The French didn't really bother defending it. They said, it's impossible. And only the pilots know how to get up and down. It's sort of, you need the local knowledge passed down from the sun. James Cook says, no. He creates the first chart, and the British astonish the French by arriving in Quebec, the capital of their empire in New France, in front of the walls of Quebec with a gigantic fleet. With a huge number of troops on board, and stay there the whole summer. It's actually quite a complicated summer, and it's as Tom, who's one of the three people on this earth outside my immediate family that read my book 10 years ago, for which I'm eternally grateful. Tom,
I've read your book, Dan.
and so they eventually
it's
take.
Good. It's a really good book.
Come on,
why do you think nobody read it?
Well, because I have access to data.
No, listen, we're not getting into unjustly neglected books. I'm sure this episode will clean up the bestseller list again.
Okay, so they capture Quebec eventually. Absolute nightmare, terrifyingly difficult. They almost all die of typhus and dysentery and the rest of it. They all fall out with each other. James Wolfe is deeply unpopular with his fellow commanders' subordinates. It's not arguably not really his plan, in fact, that they eventually land at this this very lightly defended. It's amphibious. It's what Britain does really well. It's what they've done well in India. It's what they're going to do well in the Caribbean. It's what they do well all the way up until deep into the 20th century. They do it in China in the 19th century. Is they use this extraordinary navy and the navy. We think of the navy sailing around big battleships in deep water. The navy. This is about small boats in very shallow water. water, penetrating deep into the heart of continents. They land these Highlanders and they scale up the heights of Abraham. They catch the French by surprise and they defeat the French army on the plains of Abraham. And Wolfe is killed. Does the thing you always should do in life if you're a commander. Nelson does it. Wellington fails to do it stupidly. Gordon does it. And he's killed at the moment of victory. And
he also says this fantastic lines, doesn't he? What is it? Now God be praised, I can die in peace, or something, when he's told the French are running before him. Is this true?
And you should be painted. And you should be painted looking like a martyr.
Well, he's then painted by Benjamin West, who famously then later paints Nelson, and that becomes, I think, the most widely distributed image of the 18th century. I mean, it is as rule Britannia. This is a kind of crucible for a Britishness that we recognise. You know, this is a kind of tempting to use the word nationalist, but that's probably a little bit anachronistic. But it's this idea that Britain, that God was an Englishman, that Britain had exactly, and we've all read our Linda Colley, and Royal Britannia becomes, and Magna Carta is displayed, by the way, during this period famously. The British Museum is founded, and Magna Carta is put on a huge big public display in the British Museum, and it's just labelled as the bulwark of our liberties. And so there's this link between monumental warfare, British success on the battlefield. There's an Anglo-Scottish element here, because lots of these British troops are former Jacobite soldiers who are now fighting for the British crown.
So and Highlanders.
Exactly. So there's a really interesting kind of British story emerging here. And then this idea of kind of English-British exceptionalism as well, through Magna Carta, through museums, all that kind of stuff. So it's really interesting. Then one of the most remarkable moments of 1759, as well as Frederick the Great is at the moment in Europe contemplating suicide. He's doing so badly,
like Hitler, right? So this is the bit that Hitler in the bunker is reading up on Frederick the Great and getting inspiration from it,
right? Because he Frederick the Great had lost Berlin by this stage. He's lost half his army in one particular battle. It is absolutely. He's been crushed, but he's been kept in the field by British money. And then the most extraordinary thing ever, which is the Tsar died, the Tsarina dies, and this new Tsar comes in who just likes Frederick the Great and just unilaterally leaves his alliance with Maria Theresa. I mean, Maria Theresa is one of the most long-suffering and remarkable women in the history of the world, and that's up against some pretty tough competition. And she, as she's on the verge of victory, this idiotic, childlike Russian Tsar reverses. Exactly. He is then got rid of by Catherine the Great, his wife, but not before he's lent a big chunk of his army to Frederick and basically got Frederick out of trouble. So Europe's just stable enough for the British to mop up everywhere else. They capture Guadeloupe, they capture a chunk of West Africa, slave trading ports in West Africa, slave gathering fortresses in West Africa. And then at the end of the year, just when things couldn't have gone any better at all, you get this extraordinary moment, the greatest naval battle in British history, which people should know about and they don't, which is the Battle of Quiberon Bay, in which Sir Edward Hawke, I'm a bigger Nelson fan as the next guy. This is happening. This is the excitement of podcasts. They're so daring.
You just don't know, do you? You don't know what's going to happen next.
Nelson commanded a detached fleet. He was not in charge of the Channel Squadron. He could do what he liked. It was fine. He was down in the Mediterranean. He could take a few gambles, okay? Sir Edward Hawke is commanding the Royal Naval Fleet responsible for protecting the British Isles against French invasion, okay? And he finds that the French fleet have sailed. They're going to join up with their transports. Big problem with geography, by the way. There is no port. This is why God is, in fact, an Englishman. There is no port in northern France which can have a large army sitting in it and is deep enough for battleships all to be there at the same time. You have Brest, which is bad, by the way, for the wind, but you have Brest, but there is not enough food in that tiny tip of Britain. You think about where Brest is on the tip of Britain. It's bloody miles away from anywhere else in France. You can't take enough food there. So you've got this permanent problem with trying to invade England, which you have to keep the transports containing the soldiers in a different place to the big battleships. They've got rubbish harbours in northern France, which is why, following the Seven Years' War, the King of France decided to try and build Cherbourg as a massive seawall to create a port capable of taking on the British, and bankrupt the French regime by doing that. And everyone said he was throwing rocks into the sea and throwing his money into the sea. Anyway, we'll come back to that. So this, the fleet has sailed. They're meeting up with the transports. Hawke intercepts them. And in November, in a rising gale in November, off a brutal coast off Quiberon Bay, famously littered with shoals and rocks and inlets. Hawk says, cram on more sail. We are going to sail into Quiberon Bay, uncharted territory, basically, for the Brits. We're going to follow those French who are hiding in there. They think they're getting away from us. As this autumnal gale is rising, as the sun is setting, and at sunset, Hawk scores this astonishing victory against the French, ships capsizing in the wind. Just amazing story in amongst the rocks of Quiberon Bay.
And Dan, is that like... Is that because it's like going up the St. Lawrence River that the Navy have the charts that enable them to negotiate the shoals, or is it just kind of, oh, we're going to take a punt on this?
It's a bit of both. First of all, it's certainly like the Navy going up the St. Lawrence River, a confidence in the seamanship of your naval ratings and officers. What is also happening is for the first successful time in the Seven Years' War, which is astonishingly important and dramatic innovation, is all of the... Again, the modernity of this state, its ability to create systems. You, for the first time in ever, you have a successful blockade of French ports. You don't just say, we're going to keep an eye on the French, and when they come out, we're going to fight them. You say, they will not leave port. We will blockade them in for not just weeks, but for months and years. So their sailors will not be trained. Their ships will rot at their, you know, they will lose their morale.
This is the first...
Yes.
Tryout of a strategy that's then used in the Napoleonic Wars, First World War.
It's tried earlier, but after 3 weeks, these ships come back. Everyone's got scurvy. It's just the crews are falling. You destroy your own fleet by blockading. That's the problem.
Dan, we need to take a break. Our listeners will be... They need to have a swig of grog comfort or
break.
Something. Yeah, comfort break. And then they can return.
And on the lemon. but I think... I mean, we've covered the sweep of the war. And when we come back, perhaps we've got some questions and we can try and put all this in the slightly broader perspective.
When your visitors go for a drink, let them remember the toast of the Royal Navy that derives straight from this period. May our officers have the eye of a hawk and the heart of a wolf.
A splendid note. A splendid note on which to go to a commercial break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History and the 7 Years' War. We're with Dan Snow talking about it. Dan, so you gave us a brilliant account of the course of the war, and we were majoring on the scale of British triumphs. And for generations, these triumphs have been kind of iconic. So we talked about the death of Wolfe, Battle of Quiberon Bay, also the Battle of Plassey, where
Clive of India,
Clive of India, kind of basically wins, as it turns out, India for the nascent British Empire. So, great scenes that have long been celebrated. However, I think it's fair to say that the idea that this is necessarily great for the world is now more contested than it was. So the idea that Clive of India has a statue in Whitehall, there are grumblings about it. Do you think that that is one of the reasons why the Seven Years' War has been generally forgotten? And is it kind of now problematic in a way that wasn't for earlier generations? The robust voice of Middle England is grumbling away in the background. But I mean, that's the kind of issue, isn't it? That it's more complicated now, perhaps, than it was to celebrate someone like Wolfe.
Yes, you're exactly right. There are two. I think there's two issues. One is that it has fallen out of favour because it has been succeeded by other greater wars, which inevitably, like the way that Churchill obscures Lloyd George, who obscures Pitt the Younger and Palmerston. You know, I think in terms of historical memory, we kind of only have place for one particular national military endeavour. And of course, Second World War looms so large today. But I expect the Second World War will go through this process that the Seven Years' War has gone through. I mean, our parents grew up. I mean, the Seven Years' War was essential. G.A. Henty books. I had a bizarre upbringing of kind of reading strange Edwardian books that were left around my grandma's house. And, you know,
you're not alone.
Well, I think I'm among friends here, but I was kind of radicalised, and I'm having to unradicalise myself carefully as I enter middle age. I'm doing the opposite to many people's journeys. But Wolfe in Quebec, Clive in India were foundational stories, people. And in a way, because they were. I mean, Wolfe's victory at Quebec, in short order, delivered the whole of New France. I mean, very briefly, before the American Revolution, we should remember. I mean, the whole of North America, virtually, apart from the New Spain, which stretched up into...
A question from the splendidly maritime-sounding Jacob Hawkins. If England had lost the Seven Years' War, do we still get the British Empire and or the War of Independence? So let's leave the War of Independence to one side. But the British Empire, I mean, basically, this is the war that creates the British Empire. As
we recognise, as the 9th century understand it. So therefore, that's problematic in itself. That's not something for unalloyed celebration, which it was 100 years ago. There is this issue. I mentioned Martinique, which is captured. Guadeloupe, I mentioned, captured. Martinique in 1762. West Africa, Senegal. You know, these places in West Africa are captured. That's about the slave trade. That's about the trade in enslaved human beings. Vastly and amazingly, there's this great moment where France has a Canada or Guadeloupe moment, which has become a kind of celebrated thing in international international affairs kind of studies, is that there's this moment when the French have to decide, do they ask for Canada back at the negotiating table or Guadeloupe? And they choose Guadeloupe, amazingly. The second largest country on earth now, with vast oil, you know, incredible wealth. It was rejected by Canada. People like Voltaire said it was a few acres of frozen snow and it was just the beavers. It was just the hats that it was the only thing useful for. So and that's because sugar was grown, the super commodity of the 18th century, sugar was grown by enslaved people on those islands. Hugely, hugely profitable. The trade derived the money, the cash flowing into venture capitalist pockets in Britain, as we have all rehearsed now, we all know, where the slave trade was hugely important within that development of the early of 18th century British economy, politics, society, all that stuff. So that's why it's difficult to celebrate. We now know more about Robert Clive. I mean, he was, I'm afraid, an unattractive character. He struggled
with his mental health. I think that's how you'd rehabilitate him, isn't it?
Sorry, absolutely, that's correct.
You'd say he was a martyr to his mental health.
That's correct as well. However, the victory at Plassey was not a victory of kind of plucky British spirit against the kind of oriental, weak oriental, despotic, unvirile fighters. It was just a gigantic bribery. It was, you know, there was cash exchange between rogue Indian sort of magnates and the East India Company and people like that. So it is harder to, of course.
Do you think there's a case for saying that the British Empire and the conquest of vast swathes of the world was kind of incidental to the core British ambition, which was to beat the French?
I think it was incidental. This is a really wonderful question, because in terms of getting territory, as you guys know, painting the world pink was always quite unpopular among huge swathes of policymakers and people in Whitehall. It's really expensive. you get massive blowback. So for one great example, after the Seven Years' War, you get the British government say, right, we might now have conquered technically this bloody enormous area in North America, but they banned their British settlers, their North American settlers, from settling in the back country of Pennsylvania, which is a huge reason for the American Revolution. Because the Brits go, the last thing we want to do is control a kind of trans-American state. Yeah. It's going to cost a ton of money. And the locals hate us. And you get this Pontiac's revolt. You get North American natives fighting the Brits and fighting these settlers. So it is, as the great expression, that British Empire in Africa was acquired in a kind of a fit of absence of mind, when all they were trying to do was protect the Suez Canal. So I think there is an element that Europe, the good old-fashioned sense of power politics within Europe, and also the British wanted to get rich. And in those days, getting rich had a mercantilist element to it. It was thought you had to control the islands of the Caribbean to take advantage of this trade in sugar. It should be British ships carrying that sugar. They should be crewed by British crews. They should use British ports. They should cross-ship to other ships that then export it to Europe. So, yes, to beat the French, but it was about money and economic clout as much as beating them on a battlefield.
But Dan, there's this argument, isn't there? Brendan Sims has this argument, Cambridge historian, that the way we think about Britain and its world role and the evolution of the empire and the Seven Years' War as a foundational moment in that is all wrong, because we're looking at Canada and we're looking at India, and he argues that the action was all really in Europe, and that Europe was what mattered to British policymakers, that we've sort of written that out of history, and that we're too obsessed with the kind of global Britain, and that we don't realise how much the establishment cared about Europe above all.
Could I just mix that point in with the question from Stephen Clark, good friend of the show? The Seven Years' War establish Prussia as a great power? So that is always the other aspect of the Seven Years' War to keep in mind, is the Prussian dimension.
Well, Tom, is well done, Stephen Clark, and well done, Tom, for that very lovely segue of marrying everyone together. We're all singing harmony now. But Dominic, you're absolutely right. And of course, what's interesting, we all, in 1910, when the British Empire did cover 1920, when it covered 25% of the Earth's landmass, clearly these campaigns we're talking about, General Wolfe in Quebec, feels vitally important in that story. Now that we're looking at a Europe dominated by Germany and a world in which the British Empire no longer matters or exists, we suddenly think, oh, you know what, maybe that whole Frederick the Great thing was a bit more important than we were noticing, which of course is exactly what King George II and the Duke of Newcastle were primarily focused on. They were focused on the balance of power in Europe. They wanted to access, they did not want a hegemonic power emerging in Europe. They assumed it would be the French. And they wanted, therefore, Frederick the Great, this kind of useful North German counterweight to Austro-French power in Europe. Now, of course, Prussia doubles in size during his rule. Funnily enough, during the Seven Years' War, it actually doesn't. It's more like he's tested by the most astonishing, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, he's hardened by fire in the Seven Years' War. He gains Silesia at the beginning of the War of Austrian Succession, which actually, as you know, is probably the most important thing ever to happen in the history of Europe, because that's where the rot sets in. I mean, if you want to, you know, Prussia, the end of Austria-Hungary, slow decline. I mean, him seizing Silesia in 1740 from the young Austrian new ruler, Maria Theresa, is the moment when everything turns. It's the fulcrum. There's probably some Julius Caesar moment you could give me about him becoming Pontifex, whatever it was, Tom. But that's kind of the moment. And the Seven Years' War reinforces that conquest. Maria Theresa goes all out. She sells her jewellery. She goes all out to get Silesia back. She defends Bohemia. But she doesn't get Silesia back. Frederick's allowed to keep his gains in Europe, and they will expand as he starts to partition Poland later on. So Prussia now, and sitting now in the 21st century, when Germany is a significant thing, and it is derived from that Prussian experiment, that Prussian success in the 18th century, you can say, yeah, we should probably be thinking more about Europe than in the Seven Years' War.
It is amazing to think of that, to think of the kind of the Europe of today as being set in the Seven Years' War, but also the spread of Anglophone culture, the fact that the United States of America speaks English, that India is an English-speaking country.
Imagine if Canada was French as a counterweight, as a linguistic, cultural counterweight to the US, Tom. You know, if there was a Canadian Hollywood that was French-speaking, I mean, the world would be utterly, culture would be so,
Dominic Sambrook, I sense, is not a fan of the wonderful and very, very dynamic Montreal film scene.
a film scene of which I was hitherto unaware.
Barbarian Invasions is one of the great films. As a Canadian citizen, I will know. But you're right. And of course, Bismarck, brilliant. My favourite quote about Samuel Rawls, Bismarck, the Anglophone stuff, the fact that people wazz on about Magna Carta more outside Britain than they do inside Britain, the fact that the Australians, the Indians, the Americans have got parliamentary traditions that date, that all stem from this fun little island of ours. All of that stuff, of course, is fun. The Seven Years' War makes that very important. And Bismarck brilliantly says, at the end of the 19th century, Bismarck, as you know, he retired to his estate. Kaiser Wilhelm kind of kicked him out, and he was in a foul mood for the rest of his life. And a young journalist, I think it was, went and said, you know, what do you think will be the most important? You know, when we're looking at the new, the 20th century, what is it that will really determine the course of the 20th century? And Bismarck answers immediately, the fact that North America speaks English. And he's exactly right. You know, the great, the monumental battles of the 20th century, first against Imperial Germany, then against fascism, and then against communism. It is that coalition of English-speaking Anglo-Saxon capitalist economies that gather together and are able to overcome those. And that is absolutely essential.
Dan, you are the Arthur Bryant of history, clearly, with all this English-speaking democracy.
Sorry,
stuff.
I know. Daniel Hannan is listening, and he's getting a serious.
We're coming to a close. So I've got two questions here, both of which, of course, put this back into an 18th-century perspective. One of them is from Dr. Tony O'Donnell, and he asks: Is the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, America's forgotten creation myth? Washington and others lead in a war that later taxes sought to repay, and the colonials rejected the cost of their own defence. And then we have a great comment from Jim Zhu. Lord Newcastle was generally regarded as a buffoon, in part over his staunch support for the Anglo-Austrian alliance that blew up and dragged Europe into war. 20 years later, Lord North lost America because of diplomatic isolation. Who's the greater buffoon in hindsight?
Yeah.
So I guess both of those, that the roots of the American War of Independence lie in the victories that Britain wins.
But two revolutions, Tom, right? America and France. Okay.
I think that's right, Dominic. I think the French go away and decide to try and compete with Britain at sea and spend unimaginable amounts of money doing so, like I said earlier, and directly contributes towards their bankruptcy. But also, the disaster of the American Revolutionary War is sort of stems, I think, from two areas. One is that Britain, and there was an active debate within Britain around the peace treaty, is what we don't want to do is become the new Louis XIV. We don't want to be the baddies, you know, that great sketch. Are we the bad guys? They were terribly nervous about appearing to be a European hegemon. And I think they largely failed in that because they thought they'd give a bit more back to France on the peace treaty. That would avoid them being unpopular. They actually kind of failed at both. They neither held on to everything, nor did they stop this overwhelming impression. Britain was now the problem in Europe. And so, for example, the Dutch, other European nations, when it comes to the War of Independence, they either neutral, pretty hostile neutral, or they back the Americans. But in a more direct sense...
Did the Portuguese stay with us?
The Portuguese in the American Revolutionary War, I don't know about.
Oh, well, we'll check that out.
Yeah,
I'm sure they did.
I don't know.
They would never let us down, the Portuguese.
Would never let us down, no.
And I think, but in a very direct sense, of course... The Seven Years' War is the American foundation myth because you do that terrible thing, which is you remove the threat. And the American colonies had lived under the dagger of French and Native Americans only, you know, miles from the big cities of the Eastern Seaboard. You know, Montcalm comes very close to the big settlements of the Eastern Seaboard. The French are now gone. Britain controls the continent. The Native Americans have no allies anymore. They are terribly bereft, and they are then, as we know, an awful dystopian story, what happens to them. And so there's this great quote from a colonial governor, and he said, you know, what did British gain? And I think he said, from the most glorious and successful war which she has ever engaged upon, and that she gained an empire that she was unable to defend, maintain or govern, because she was then had this giant empire that she couldn't pay for, and Britain tried to tax the American colonists for their protection, in my opinion entirely reasonably. All right, anyway, so they a standing military force was now required to protect this giant empire. They fell out with the Americans, and the Americans looked around and went, hold on a minute, I don't think we need the Brits anymore. We do not need these guys protecting us. We have got all the advantages now of this giant hinterland. Let's shift the Brits. So in a very real sense...
So massive ingratitude.
massive
gratitude.
Huge
tax dodge, isn't it? I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Well, and they all the Virginia planters didn't have to
American
pay their
listeners are enjoying this.
Well, yeah. all the tax dodge.
We just lost that 20% of our audience.
A tax dodge. Oh, no, don't worry, he'll come back. And a tax dodge. it was not only a tax dodge; it was also a giant debt. You know, they didn't the Virginia planters, the terribly indebted Virginia planters, London basically went, we're not going to pay our debts now. We're going independent. So yes, it was.
Right, and on that somber note. That somber and disgraceful note. We've brought the 7 Years' War to an end. We've demonstrated that Thackeray was talking nonsense. Yeah. It's perfectly possible to explain the course of the 7 Years' War.
Tom, we must never have Dan Snow back on this program again. That is for sure. He's been so rude. Yeah, he's been rude about our audience.
No, more than worth it, Dan. Can't thank you enough. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. We will see you next week, where Dominic, I think we're actually doing the French Revolution, aren't we?
French Revolution and minutes. Food. And so, food, yeah. Not in the same podcast.
The French Revolution is a kind of natural sequel to this. So
yes. So what happened next?
Yes.
And I think we'll do that. For that. We're going to do that sans
guest.
Just
us.
Yeah, just us.
Yes. Sans Dan.
I'm going to tune into that. That's going to be fantastic.
Thanks so much, Dan. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.